19. A traitor to his blood. The revelations of the arrests and the horror of the crimes held the nation in their grip. The press wrote about an evidently well-organized band, diabolic in its ruthlessness, to destroy with bullet, poison, and bomb the heirs to the oil-rich lands of the Osage. About crimes that were more blood-curdling than those of the old frontier days, and about the federal government's effort to bring to justice the alleged King of the Killers. White had been consumed with the cases involving Roan and Molly Burkhart's family members, and he and his men had not yet been able to connect Hale to all of the 24 Osage murders or to the deaths of the attorney Vaughn and the oil man McBride. Yet White and his team were able to show how Hale benefited from at least two of these other killings. The first was the suspected poisoning of George Bighart, the Osage Indian who, before dying, had passed on information to Vaughn. White learned from witnesses that Hale had been seen with Bighart just before he was rushed to the hospital, and that after his death, Hale made a claim upon his estate for $6,000, presenting a forged creditor's note. Ernest Burkhart disclosed that Hale, before filling out the note, had practiced making his handwriting look like Bighart's. Hale was also implicated in the apparent poisoning of Joe Bates, an Osage Indian, in 1921. After Bates, who was married and had six children, suddenly died, Hale had produced a dubious deed to his land. Bates' widow later wrote a letter to the Office of Indian Affairs saying, "Hale kept my husband drunk for over a year. Hale would come to the house and ask him to sell his inherited shares in land. Joe always refused, no matter how drunk he was. I never believed that he sold that land. He always told me he would not, even up to a few days before his death. Well, Hale got the land." Despite the brutality of the crimes, many whites did not mask their enthusiasm for the lurid story. "Osage Indian killing conspiracy thrills," declared the Reno Evening Gazette, under the headline, "Old Wild West Still Lives in Land of Osage Murders." A wire service sent out a nationwide bulletin that the story, however depressing, is nevertheless blown through with a breath of the romantic, devil-may-care frontier West that we thought was gone. And it is an amazing story, too. So amazing that at first you wonder if it can possibly have happened in modern 20th century America. A newsreel about the murders, titled "The Tragedy of the Osage Hills," was shown at cinemas. "The true history of the most baffling series of murders in the annals of crime," a handbill for the show said. "A story of love, hatred, and man's greed for gold, based on the real facts as divulged by the startling confession of Burkhart." Amid the sensationalism, the Osage were focused on making sure that Hale and his conspirators did not find a way to wriggle free, as many feared they would. Bates' widow said, "We Indians cannot get our rights in these courts, and I have no chance at all of saving this land for my children." On January 15, 1926, the Society of Oklahoma Indians issued a resolution that said, "Members of the Osage tribe of Indians have been foully murdered for their head rights. Whereas the perpetrators of these alleged crimes deserve to be vigorously prosecuted and, if convicted, punished to the full extent of the law. Therefore, be it resolved by this society that we commend the federal and state officials for their efforts in trying to ferret out and prosecute the criminals guilty of these atrocious crimes." Yet White knew that America's judicial institutions, like its policing agencies, were permeated with corruption. Many lawyers and judges were on the take. Witnesses were coerced, juries tampered with. Even Clarence Darrow, the great defender of the downtrodden, had been charged with trying to bribe prospective jurors. A Los Angeles Times editor recalled Darrow once telling him, "When you're up against a bunch of crooks, you will have to play their game. Why shouldn't I?" Hale held enormous influence over Oklahoma's fragile legal institutions. As a reporter who visited the region noted, "Townspeople from low to high speak of him with bated breath. His influence and that of his associates is felt everywhere. Because of Hale's power, a federal prosecutor warned that it was not only useless but positively dangerous to try him in the state legal system. But as with many crimes against American Indians, the question of which government entity had jurisdiction over the Osage murders was confounding. If a murder occurred on Indian territory, then the federal authorities could claim jurisdiction. The Osage territory, however, had been allotted, and much of the surface land where the murders had occurred, including the slaying of Anna Brown, was no longer under the tribe's control. These cases, Justice Department officials concluded, could only be tried by the state. Yet as officials scoured the various cases, they thought that they'd found an exception. Henry Roan was killed on an Osage allotment that hadn't been sold to whites. Moreover, the Osage property owner was under guardianship and considered a ward of the federal government. Prosecutors working with White decided to move forward with this case first, and Hale and Ramsey were charged in federal court with Roan's murder. They faced the death penalty. The assembled prosecution team was formidable. It included two high-ranking officials in the Justice Department, as well as a young, newly appointed U.S. attorney, Roy St. Louis, and a local attorney named John Leahy, who was married to an Osage woman and who had been hired by the tribal council to assist in the various trials. Hale was aided by his own array of lawyers, some of the ablest legal talent of Oklahoma, as one newspaper put it. Among them was Sergeant Prentice Freeling, a former Oklahoma attorney general and a staunch advocate of states' rights. He had often traveled around the region giving a lecture titled "The Trial of Jesus Christ from a Lawyer's Standpoint," warning, "When a small-natured man indulges to the extent of his ability in villainy and goes as far as his contemptible nature will permit, he then employs some disreputable lawyer to assist him." To defend John Ramsey, Roan's alleged shooter, Hale hired an attorney named Jim Springer, who was known as a fixer. Under Springer's counsel, Ramsey quickly recanted his confession, insisting, "I never killed anyone." Ernest Burkhart told White that Hale had earlier assured Ramsey not to worry, that he, Hale, was on the inside and had everything fixed from the road overseer to the governor. Soon after the grand jury proceedings began in early January, one of Hale's cronies, a pastor, was charged with committing perjury on the stand. At a later proceeding, another associate was arrested for trying to intoxicate witnesses. As the trial neared, crooked private eyes began trailing witnesses and even trying to make them disappear. The Bureau put out a physical description for one private eye who agents feared might be hired as an assassin. "Long face, gray suit and light fedora hat, several gold teeth. Has reputation as being very cunning and slippery." Another gunman was hired to assassinate Kelsey Morrison's former wife, Catherine Cole, who was Osage and had agreed to testify for the prosecution. The gunman later recalled, "Kelsey said that he wanted to make some arrangement to get shed of Catherine, his wife, because she knew too much about the Anna Brown murder deal. Kelsey said that he would give me a note to Bill Hale and that Hale would fix the arrangements." Hale paid the gunman and told him to get her out drunk and get rid of her. But at the last minute, the gunman wouldn't go through with it, and after being picked up on a robbery charge, he told authorities about the plan. Still, the plots continued. White, who had ordered his men to work in pairs for security, received a tip that a former member of the Al Spencer gang had shown up in Pawhuska to kill federal agents. White told Agent Smith, "We'd better head this off," and armed with 45 automatics, they confronted the man at a house where he was staying. "We hear you've threatened to run us out of town," White said. The outlaw assessed the lawmen and said, "I'm just a friend of Bill Hale's. Just happened in town is all." White subsequently informed Hoover, "Before this man could put into execution any of his dirty work, he left, as he was given to understand that it would be healthier for him some other place." White was extremely concerned about Ernest Burkhart. Hale later told one ally that Burkhart was the only witness he was afraid of. Whatever you do, you get to Ernest, Hale told him. Otherwise, he said, I'm a ruined man. On January 20th, 1926, Burkhart, whom the government had not yet charged, waiting to see the extent of his cooperation, told White that he was sure he was going to be bumped off. I'll give you all the protection the government can afford, White promised him, whatever is necessary. White arranged for Agent Wren and another member of his team to spirit Burkhart out of the state and guard him until the trial. The agents never registered Burkhart in hotels under his own name and referred to him by the alias E.J. Ernest. White later told Hoover, We think that it is likely that they will endeavor to kill Burkhart. Of course, every precaution is being taken to prevent such a step, but there are many ways that this could be done, for friends of Ramsey and Hale could probably slip poison to him. Molly, meanwhile, still didn't believe that Ernest was intentionally guilty. And when he did not return home for days, she became frantic. Her whole family had been decimated, and now it appeared as if she'd lost her husband, too. An attorney assisting the prosecution asked whether she'd feel better if agents brought her to see Ernest. That is all I wanted, she said. Afterward, White and Molly met. He promised her that Ernest would be back soon. Until then, White said, he would make sure that they could correspond. After Molly received a letter from Ernest saying that he was well and safe, she replied, Dear husband, I received your letter this morning and was very glad to hear from you. We are all well, and Elizabeth is going back to school. Molly noted that she was no longer so sick. I feel better now, she said, clinging to the illusion of their marriage. She concluded, Well, Ernest, I must close my short letter, hoping to hear from you soon. Goodbye from your wife, Molly Burkhart. On March 1st, 1926, White and the prosecution received a devastating setback. The judge, agreeing with a defense motion, ruled that even though Roan's murder had occurred on an individual Osage allotment, this was not the equivalent of tribal lands, and therefore the case could be adjudicated only in state court. Prosecutors appealed the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, but with a ruling not expected for months, Hale and Ramsey would have to be released. It appeared that Bill Hale's lawyers, just as his friends predicted, had clipped the government's tail feathers good, one writer observed. Hale and Ramsey were celebrating in the courtroom when they were approached by Sheriff Frias. He shook hands with Hale, then said, Bill, I have a warrant for your arrest. White and prosecutors had worked with the Oklahoma Attorney General to keep Hale and Ramsey behind bars by filing state charges against them for the bombing murders. White and the prosecutors had no choice but to initiate the state case in Pawhuska, the Osage County seat and a Hale stronghold. Very few, if any, believe that we can ever be able to get a jury in Osage County to try these parties, White told Hoover. Trickeries and all methods of deceit will be resorted to. At a preliminary hearing on March 12th, Osage men and women, many of them relatives of the victims, crammed into the courtroom to bear witness. Hale's wife, his 18-year-old daughter, and as many boisterous supporters clustered behind the defense table. Journalists jostled for space. Seldom, if ever, has such a crowd gathered in a courtroom before, a reporter from the Tulsa Tribune wrote. Here are well-groomed businessmen contesting standing room with roustabouts. There are society women sitting side by side with Indian squaws in gaudy blankets. Cowboys in broad-brimmed hats and Osage chiefs in beaded garb drink in the testimony. Schoolgirls craned forward in their seats to hear it. All the cosmopolitan population of the world's richest spot, the kingdom of the Osage, crowd to catch the drama of blood and gold. A local historian later ventured that the Osage murder trials received more media coverage than the previous year's Scopes monkey trial in Tennessee regarding the legality of teaching evolution in a state-funded school. Many people in the gallery gossiped about an Osage woman who was sitting on one of the benches, quiet and alone. It was Molly Burkhart, cast out from the two worlds that she'd always straddled. Whites loyal to Hale shunned her, while many Osage ostracized her for bringing the killers among them and for remaining loyal to Ernest. Reporters portrayed her as an ignorant squaw. The press hounded her for a statement, but she refused to give one. Later, a reporter snapped her picture, her face defiantly composed, and a new and exclusive picture of Molly Burkhart was transmitted around the world. Hale and Ramsey were escorted into the courtroom. Though Ramsey appeared indifferent, Hale acknowledged his wife and daughter and supporters confidently. "Hale is a man of magnetic personality," the Tribune reporter wrote. "Friends crowd about him at every recess of court, and men and women shout cheerful greetings." In jail, Hale had jotted down these lines from a poem as he remembered them. "Judge not. The clouds of seeming guilt may dim thy brother's fame, for fate may throw suspicion's shade upon the brightest name." White sat down at the prosecution table. In an instant, one of Hale's lawyers said, "Your Honor, I demand that T.B. White over there, head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Oklahoma City, be searched for firearms and excluded from this courtroom." Hale's supporters hooted and stamped their feet. White stood, opening his coat to show that he wasn't armed. "I will leave if the court orders it," he said. The judge said that this wouldn't be necessary, and White sat back down and the crowd quieted. The hearing proceeded uneventfully until that afternoon, when a man entered the courtroom who had not been seen in Osage County for weeks, Ernest Burkhart. Molly watched her husband as he walked unsteadily down the long aisle to the stand. Hale glowered at his nephew, whom one of Hale's lawyers denounced as a traitor to his own blood. Moments before, Burkhart had confided to a prosecutor that if he testified, they'll kill me. And as Burkhart sat in the witness chair, it was evident that whatever strength he had mustered to reach this point was fading. A lawyer for Hale rose and demanded to confer privately with Burkhart. "This man is my client," he said. The judge asked Burkhart if this individual was really his attorney, and Burkhart, with one eye on Hale, said, "He's not my attorney, but I'm willing to talk to him." White and the prosecutors watched incredulously as Burkhart stepped down from the stand and went with Hale's lawyers into the judge's chambers. 5 minutes drifted by, then 10, then 20. At last, the judge ordered the bailiff to retrieve them. Hale's lawyer Freeling emerged from the chamber and said, "Your Honor, I'd like to ask the court to allow Mr. Burkhart until tomorrow to confer with the defense." The judge agreed, and for a moment Hale personally buttonholed Burkhart in the courtroom, the plot unfolding this time right in front of White. Leahy, the prosecutor who had been hired by the Osage Tribal Council, considered all this to be the most high-handed and unusual course of conduct I had ever witnessed on the part of attorneys. As Burkhart left the courtroom, White strove to catch his attention, but Burkhart was swept away by a mob of Hale supporters. The next morning in court, one of the prosecutors made the announcement that White and everyone in the buzzing gallery were expecting. Ernest Burkhart refused to testify for the state. In a memo to Hoover, White explained that Burkhart's nerve went back on him, and after he was allowed to see Hale and once more be placed under his domination, there was no hope of his testifying. Instead, Burkhart took the stand as a defense witness. One of Hale's lawyers asked him if he'd ever spoken to Hale about the murder of Roan or any other Osage Indian. "I never did," Burkhart murmured. When the lawyer asked if Hale had ever requested that he hire someone to kill Roan, Burkhart said, "He never did." Step by step, in a quiet, monotone voice, Burkhart recanted. Prosecutors tried to salvage their case by filing separate charges against Burkhart, naming him as a co-conspirator in the bombing of the Smith's house. Hoping to bolster their position against Hale and Ramsey by gaining an early conviction against Burkhart, prosecutors scheduled his trial first. But the two most important pillars of evidence against Hale, the confessions of Burkhart and Ramsey, had crumbled. White recalled that in the courtroom, Hale and Ramsey gave us triumphant grins, adding, "The king on top again." When Burkhardt's trial began in late May, White found himself in the midst of an even greater crisis. Hale took the stand and testified under oath that during his interrogation, White and his agents, including Smith, had brutally tried to coerce a confession from him. Hale said that the men from the Bureau had told him that they had ways of making people talk. "I looked back," Hale continued. "What caused me to look back was hearing a pistol cocked behind me. Just as I looked back, Smith jumped across the room, grabbed me by the shoulder, and shoved a big gun in my face." Hale said that Smith had threatened to beat his brains out and that White had told him, "We will have to put you in the hot chair." Then he said the agent shoved him in a special chair, attached wires to his body, and put a black hood over his head and a device like a catcher's mask over his face. "They kept talking about putting the juice to me and electrocuting me and did shock me," Hale said. Burkhardt and Ramsey testified that they had received similar abuse, which was the only reason they had made their confessions. When Hale was on the stand, he gestured wildly, dramatizing how the electricity had allegedly jolted his body. One agent, he claimed, had sniffed the air and cried, "Don't you smell that human flesh burning?" One morning in early June, Hoover was in Washington. He liked to eat a poached egg on toast for breakfast. A relative once observed that Hoover was quite a tyrant about food, and that if the yolk seeped at all, he would send it back to the kitchen. Yet this morning, it was not the food that disturbed him. He was stunned to pick up the Washington Post and find above the fold the following headline: "Prisoner charges use of electricity by justice agents. Attempt to force him to admit murders told on stand. Officers sniffed at flesh burning," he says. While Hoover had no particular devotion to the niceties of the law, he did not seem to believe that White was capable of such tactics. What worried Hoover was scandal, or, to use his preferred term, embarrassment. He sent White an urgent telegram demanding an explanation. Though White did not want to dignify the ridiculous allegations, he promptly responded, insisting that the charges were a fabrication from start to finish, as there was absolutely no third-degree method used. "I never used such tactics in my life." White and his agents took the stand to refute the allegations. Still, William B. Pine, a U.S. senator from Oklahoma who was a wealthy oil man and had defended the guardianship system, began to lobby government officials for White and his men to be fired from the Bureau. At Ernest Burkhardt's trial, tempers could no longer be contained. When a defense attorney alleged that the government had committed fraud, a prosecutor shouted, "I'll meet the man who says it out in the courtyard." The two men had to be separated. With the government's case in trouble, prosecutors eventually called a witness who they believed could sway the jury in their favor: the bootlegger and former Bureau informant, Kelsey Morrison. White and his men had earlier confronted Morrison after learning of his deception. Morrison seemed to have only one guiding force, his own self-interest. When he thought that Hale was more powerful than the U.S. government, he'd served as a double agent for the King of the Osage. Once he was caught and realized that the government controlled his fate, he flipped sides and admitted his role in the conspiracy. Now, as rain fell and thunder clapped outside the courtroom, Morrison testified that Hale had plotted to eliminate all the members of Molly's family. Hale had informed him that he wanted to get rid of the whole damn bunch so that Ernest would get it all. As for Anna Brown, Morrison said that Hale had recruited him to bump that squaw off and had given him the weapon, a .380 automatic. Brian Burkhardt had acted as his accomplice. After making sure that Anna was good and drunk, they drove out to Three Mile Creek. Morrison's wife at the time, Cole, was with him, and he told her to stay in the car. Then he and Brian grabbed hold of Anna. She was too drunk to walk, Morrison recalled, and so they carried her down into the ravine. Eventually, Brian helped Anna sit up on a rock by the creek.
"He raised her up,"
Morrison said. A defense attorney asked.
"Pulled her up?"
"Yes, sir."
The courtroom was still. Molly Burkhart looked on, listening. The attorney continued.
"Did you tell him in what position to hold her while you shot her in the head?"
"Yes, sir."
"You stood there and directed him how to hold this drunken, helpless Indian woman down in the bottom of that canyon while you got ready to shoot a bullet into her brain?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then when he got her just in the position you wanted him to have her, then you shot a bullet from this .380 automatic?"
"Yes, sir."
"Did you move her after you shot her?"
"No, sir."
"What happened when you shot her?"
"Turned her loose and she fell back down."
"Just fell over?"
"Yes, sir."
"Did she make any outcry?"
"No, sir."
The attorney continued.
"Did you stand there and watch her die?"
"No, sir."
"You had satisfied yourself that with that gun you shot that bullet into her brain, you had killed her, didn't you?"
"Yes, sir."
Asked at one point what he had done after the shooting, he replied,
"I went home and ate supper."
Morrison's former wife, Cole, who said she hadn't come forward right after the murder because Morrison had threatened to stomp me to death, corroborated his account. She said,
"I stayed in the car alone about 25 or 30 minutes until they returned. Anna Brown was not with them, and I never saw her alive again."
On June 3rd, in the middle of the trial, Molly was called away. Her younger daughter with Ernest, Anna, whom a relative had been raising since Molly became seriously ill, had died. She was 4 years old. Little Anna, as she was called, had not been well of late, and doctors had attributed her death to illness because there seemed to be no evidence of foul play. But for the Osage, every death, every apparent act of God, was now in doubt. Molly attended the funeral. She had relinquished her daughter to another family so that she would be safe. Now she watched as little Anna in her small plain box disappeared into the grave. There were fewer and fewer Osage who knew the old prayers for the dead. Who would chant every morning at dawn for her? After the burial, Molly went straight to the courthouse, the cold stone building that seemed to hold the secrets to her grief and despair. She sat down in the gallery by herself, not saying a word, just listening. On June 7th, several days after the death of his daughter, Ernest Burkhart was being escorted from the courtroom back to the county jail. When no one was looking, he slipped a note to the deputy sheriff.
"Don't look at it now,"
he whispered. Later, when the deputy unfolded the note, he discovered that it was addressed to John Leahy, the prosecutor. It said simply, "See me tonight in the county jail, Ernest Burkhart." The deputy passed the note to Leahy, who found Burkhart in his cell pacing restlessly. He had deep circles around his eyes as if he hadn't slept for days. "I'm through lying, Judge," Burkhart said, the words rushing out of him. "I don't want to go on with this trial any longer." "Being with the prosecution, I'm in no position to advise you," Leahy said. "Why don't you tell your lawyers?"
"I can't tell them," Burkhart said.
Leahy looked at Burkhart, not sure if the impending confession was yet another trick. But Burkhart looked sincere. The death of his daughter, the haunting face of his wife each day at the trial, the realization that the evidence against him was piling up, it was too much to withstand. "I'm absolutely helpless," Burkhart said. He beseeched Leahy to ask Flint Moss, an attorney whom Burkhart knew, to come see him. Leahy agreed. And on June 9th, Burkhart returned to the courtroom after having spoken to Moss. This time, Burkhart did not sit at the defense table with Hale's team of attorneys. He walked to the bench and whispered something to the judge. Then he stepped back, breathing loudly, and said,
"I wish to discharge the defense attorneys. Mr. Moss will now represent me."
There were protests from the defense, but the judge agreed to the request. Moss stood beside Ernest and pronounced,
"Mr. Burkhart wishes to withdraw his plea of not guilty and enter a plea of guilty."
Gasps filled the courtroom.
Is this your desire, Mr. Burkhart? The judge asked.
It is.
Have state or federal officials offered you immunity or clemency if you change your plea?
No.
He had decided to throw himself at the mercy of the court, having earlier told Moss, I'm sick and tired of all this. I want to admit exactly what I did.
Burkhart now read a statement admitting that he delivered a message from Hale to Ramsey saying to let Kirby know it was time to blow up the Smith House.
I feel in my heart that I did it because I was requested to do it by Hale, who is my uncle, he said. The truth of what I did I have told to many men, and as I see it, the honest and honorable thing for me to do was to stop the trial and acknowledge the truth.
The judge said that before he accepted the plea, he needed to ask a question. Had federal agents forced Burkhart to sign a confession at gunpoint or under threat of electrocution?
Burkhart said that other than keeping him up late, the men from the Bureau had treated him just fine. Later, Burkhart said that some of Hale's attorneys had prodded him to lie on the stand. The judge said, "Then your plea of guilty will be accepted."
The courtroom erupted.
The New York Times reported on the front page, Burkhart admits Oklahoma killing. Confesses he hired man to dynamite Smith home. Says uncle headed plot. White sent a message to Hoover. Burkhart, he reported, was very much disturbed and with tears in his eyes, told me that he had lied and that he was now going to tell the truth and would testify to any court in the United States to that effect. After Burkhart's admission, the campaign to fire White and his men ended. Oklahoma's attorney general said, "Too much credit cannot be given these gentlemen."
Yet only a fraction of the case had been completed. White and the authorities still had to convict the other henchmen, including Brian Burkhart and Ramsey. And most treacherous of all, they still had to bring down Hale. White, after witnessing the shenanigans in Ernest's trial, was less certain that Hale could be convicted, but he received at least one encouraging bit of news. The U.S. Supreme Court had ruled that the place where Roan had been murdered was indeed on Indian lands. That put us back in federal district courts, White noted.
On June 21, 1926, Burkhart was sentenced to life imprisonment and hard labor.
Even so, the people around him detected relief on his face. A prosecutor said that he was now someone whose mind is at ease because he has relieved his tortured soul of a terrible secret and now seeks repentance and forgiveness. Before being led away in irons to the state penitentiary, Burkhart turned and smiled wanly at Molly. But her expression remained impassive, perhaps even cold.